All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 21 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today we're going to take a closer look at life in pharaonic Egypt. Our focus is going to be on this aspect of the pharaonic system, pharaonic society. That's our adjective form of the word pharaoh, right? So in a sense, Egyptian society was pharaoh-centric, if we want to use a term that we are returning to regularly here in our course this year, this idea of the centricity of a particular society or of a phenomenon. We often encounter that. And certainly in a certain sense, on a socially, politically, we could say that Egyptian society was pharaocentric, or the other word for that would be pharaonic. So our goal today, though, is to understand the, in some cases, the advantages, some cases, perhaps the benefits of, and we can, you know, say to whom and in what ways, of having such a system. But we're going to focus primarily on the pitfalls and the liabilities of such a system. Because what we know, again, we study history present-centrically, what we know about Egyptian society and about Egyptian civilization overall as a historical phenomenon is that it was a society that achieved a certain standard, a certain plateau of social and political life, and that was better than whatever had come before. It certainly, you know, we've talked about this point that we encounter societies in history at a point where they have solved certain problems and recognized certain truths, one of them being the necessity of ordering a society by means of government. So life in Egypt reached that level. The people of Egypt knew how to grow food. The people of Egypt knew how to write. Some of them anyway, right, within their ranks. And they knew how to organize a society with a central government. So these are like little crucial checkboxes for all societies. We don't encounter anything in history unless these checkboxes are checked off. And the Egyptians had accomplished that, and they reached a certain level. But, and we can acknowledge that, and it's something to look at, and it's why we bother studying archaic Egypt at all. But present-centrically, we can look back on that society and we can say, all right, it reached a certain plateau, but that plateau is nowhere near as good as what we've got today. It's really incommensurate. It's primitive. It's really quite pitiful in a variety of ways. And from our vantage point, we would certainly not look back to a world like that and pine for it, or, you know, in any way think that, wow, wouldn't it be better to go back and live in that way rather than the way that we live today? Right. So what we are doing is really trying to look back on that society, learn what we can from it, but really all the while acknowledging that this is an extinct way of life, and there's something about it that really just deserves to be extinct, and that humanity has moved on, and with good reason. And we know that certainly one dimension of progress that human beings have been able to enact is the adoption of popular forms of government, namely democracy and republic, are certainly superior to pharaonic monarchy. And we also know that living in a society that has science and technology is far superior to one that is completely dominated by the kind of superstition that we see in pharaonic Egypt. So we're looking back to this, and to study it present-centrically, you know, we need to embrace these truths, We want to see what the Egyptians did and what life was like, but we are going to inevitably look back on it as something that failed, and we have to be honest and willing to face that, and not kind of whitewash it or pretend that it was anything else than it was, and so on. So there's an element here of an important necessity of identifying both the virtues and the flaws and the problems and so on of a society like that. Okay. And this is really crucial to studying history, right? Because a lot of people, as I've said so many times, and now we're trying to tackle this from a slightly different angle today. Okay. A lot of people look back on history and they say, who cares? A lot of people look back on history and they say, you know, why does this matter? Well, And they can't see why, because of the way that it's taught. One of the huge mistakes that historians make, among the so many that they make, sadly, is that they refuse to really judge anything. And they try to make history what they think is objective by making it free of any values, making it free of any judgments. So they just present the facts. Well, guess what? That's a scam. Because you know already, I mean, we've talked about the different kinds of judgments that you have to make in order to study history. One of them, historical value judgments, concern the importance of things. If you can't figure out what's important and what's not from the past, then all you do is study a bunch of useless stuff. Then on the other hand, if you can't figure out what's good and not good about societies in the past, well, then again, you are denying yourself a really crucial what matters to us, right? What really matters deeply to us as human beings. We're talking about values. So if you can't make any heads or tails of the values of societies and make any judgments with regard to that, you also are losing a crucial dimension to history. And you end up with a subject that is hollow. You end up with a subject that just doesn't teach you anything worth learning. Because if all you've got, you might say, okay, we want to study the important stuff, but we're never going to say whether or not something is good or bad. Well, you've basically just hollowed out one of these crucial dimensions of human life, and you said, we're not going to allow that into history. Well, how does that make any sense? So historians have gotten themselves into a huge mess with regard to these things for a variety of reasons. If you study the history of history, you'll find out why. But anyway, that is a different story. But when we look at this society, as I said, present-centrically, we are looking at a failed way of life. We are looking at an inferior way of life. It's an extinct way of life. And from a modern perspective, we have a certain insight that we can bring to bear and need to bring to bear on that in order to make proper sense of it, so that we don't waste our time on something that doesn't deserve more, right? And spend too much time, for instance, on Egypt, as opposed to something else, something that really does matter. We've got to learn, in order to engage in history properly, we've got to learn how to judge things. And so we're going to spend some time today in particular, on the pitfalls of this pharaonic system. What were its really critical weaknesses? Why was it, in the end, an unviable way of organizing life? And why did ultimately Egypt get surpassed by much younger but more dynamic civilizations? Civilizations that somehow were simply better, and that left Egypt in the dust. And ultimately Egypt is this extinct thing. So why is that? I mean, it's a fascinating question. It's a really, really crucial question to take on as a real subject, because You live in a society too. And that society has values. Which ones are good? Which ones aren't? Is it possible to know? Or is it just all subjective? You know, is it just what's good for you? It's good for you. It's good for me. It's good for me. So on. Is that a viable approach? We tolerate any kind of differences whatsoever. You know, what are the foundations of the society that we're living in? How successful is that model? How long does it have to go? How can we have a flourishing human life? These are the real questions that we want to have a history that we can bring to bear on those. And that will help us to sort through those questions. Because we have this 5,000 year record of human beings trying stuff. And then we see what happens. And so that's a heck of a lot of information, right? I mean, if we can get it straight, if we can sort it out, that's a lot of information for us to learn from and build upon as a foundation for making the best life that we can make. That's ultimately present centrism. We want useful, powerful knowledge. All right, so on that, along those lines, let's talk about the real life of pharaonic Egypt. Brief review here. Brief review to set the context. We know that it starts here. Right? We know that it starts with Menes Narmer. He becomes the pharaoh. He's wearing the crown of Upper Egypt. Then he's wearing the crown of Lower Egypt. He becomes the pharaoh through conquest. And here are all of his slaughtered victims, the fallen armies. Here is the shattered fortress of his enemy. Presumably, here is the king of Lower Egypt submitting, and he is about to die. And Menes Narmer will be the ruler of Egypt. Okay. So that gets the ball rolling. That gets the story started. We have a society that has a government, and one person is in charge of it. We call that a monarchy, right? It's the pharaoh. This pharaoh is a god king. Along the way, around 2650 or so, the pharaonic architects are going to devise the pyramid structure for the monument tombs of the pharaohs. They're going to adopt rituals and whole ways of organizing society built around this pharaonic figure. And they're going to build these massive, colossal pyramid structures to celebrate the role of the pharaoh in Egyptian society. And that's all going to peak around 2500 BC with the biggest pyramids of all. All right, so this is the society that we're looking at. Now what we want to do is look, you know, put the magnifying glass here on that upper echelon of society, that upper level of the society, and understand its mechanics more closely. Because if we do, we can see the reality of this system and really understand what were its challenges and what were some serious problems that it had, and ultimately why it failed. So let's start with, as a lead up to this theme, I mentioned that in a certain sense, Egyptian society was pharaoh-centric. But let me challenge you here to reorient your thinking a little bit to the reality of Egyptian life, which is represented by this photograph. In a certain other sense, what was the real center of Egyptian life? Theo?
The Nile.
The Nile River, right? The Egyptian life, I mean, in a most fundamental way, was Nilocentric, right? It was literally, there's no life without the Nile. Egypt is the gift of the river, as Herodotus said. All right, so, Theo, follow up on that?
Oh, oopsie.
Sorry. Okay, all right, so, and so in this in kind of a contest between the pharaohs and the Nile, who wins? What's the real center of Egyptian society? Kind of trick question here. I want to see if you can, you know, reason through this a bit. It's not necessarily a simple answer. Abby, go ahead.
I'd say definitely the Nile, because Pharaoh, yes, he is the ruler, and there's a lot centered on him, but the life of every person, the Pharaoh on down, mm-hmm. in ancient Egypt is centered upon the Nile. When it floods, when it doesn't flood, when they... Just everything is centered on that.
Okay, okay. Juliet, what did you want to add to that?
Well, I just wanted to say that the pharaohs died and they had succession. They had different pharaohs, but there was still the same Nile every year.
All right, right. So that's a permanent feature. And Abby's point is it's a more fundamental feature, right? Because pharaonic life revolved around the Nile as much as the life of the peasants, right? I mean, what was that device that reflected the primacy of the Nile in Egyptian life? Even for the pharaohs, right? If you're a pharaoh, you still gotta use one of these things in a way as a subtle recognition of the fact that you aren't really that thing that all the mythology of your society says, right? You're a person and you need this device. Theo?
A Nilometer?
Yeah. Why? What's the point of that?
Well, it would tell them how much to tax, and thus the government would be able to survive along with everyone else.
All right. So get the point here about the Nilometer in the contest between the pharaohs and the Nile. Who wins? Right? The Nile, because if you're the pharaoh, you can't just do whatever you want. There is an independent nature out there acting. You can't control those natural forces. You have to bend your will to that. Otherwise, you can end up in the position as a pharaoh where you're trying to enact certain policies that are not viable. You cannot, for instance, take 100,000 people away from their homes if the Nile River Valley has flooded to an extreme degree that year and people's own homes have been wiped out. Then there's no way you're going to be, and they're going to have to rebuild those homes in the off season. There's no way you can take them and go build a pyramid, because these people have nothing to return to and no reason to go build you a tomb. Because they've got no life themselves, and as the pharaoh, you're going to have to acknowledge that and find whatever way you can to help mitigate that particularly awful year so that the people can return to a normal life and you'll be able to tax them next year. Right? And that's the reality here of the situation is what I'm trying to focus your attention on here. And there's kind of a good story that I can't resist bringing up in connection with this, just to kind of get your, again, kind of your minds wrapped around this. It's a very unpharaonic story, okay, but very useful for instructive purposes to compare cultures. We live in a culture that has gradually evolved over time, of course. Right? We live in a culture in which we couldn't possibly accept the notion of a pharaoh. Right? The notion that these people who are debating on the television, right? That these people are in any way not human or, you know, in any way godlike, right? I mean, we have gone well beyond any such possibility. But it's interesting because if we look back at the roots of modern society, in the way that we think about our society, there's a really, really great story at the root of our society, and it's a story about an English king. And I think you'll see right away how this is so interestingly different than the pharaonic premise, the premise of the pharaonic society. The king's name was Canute. Now he is. For those of you who are familiar with English history, he's pre-1066, so he is not a really, really crucial character in our present-centric kind of telling of English history. But he's a really fascinating character for this kind of tale that was told about him, Canute the Great. And this little illustration is kind of a good one. He was held to be a really, really great king. And everybody was so impressed with him. Everybody thought he's fantastic king and everything like that. But he wanted people to understand that he was just a man. So this is the exact opposite, right, of the pharaonic premise. Okay, so even though he's king, and even though he ruled England, he was humble. And in order to dramatize this very different premise, this human premise about himself, he had his fawning courtiers, all these people that praise him and that tell him how great he is. He had them take his throne down to the sea at low tide. This is the story. And then he said, all right, I'm the king, right? You keep telling me how great I am, how amazing I am, right? And you have this notion of me as somehow this, you know, superior entity somehow, right? Okay, well, watch this. If I'm so great, all right, and I am the king of this land, well, I command the tide to stay out. So this is the dramatization right here, right? The stop sign, hand gesture. And what happens? So what's the meaning of the King Canute story, Theo?
Tide comes in just as normal.
Yeah, right? No human being can stop the tide. Okay, so what's he trying to say here, right? I'm a human being, right? This exact opposite premise, Abby?
It's basically trying to say, I'm no god king, I'm no magical person who holds enough power to control nature.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Okay. See how this is the complete opposite of the pharaonic premise, right? In the pharaonic society, the premise is this primacy of the pharaohs belonging to this community of gods, even over nature, right? Over the whole universe. And if you have the pharaonic premise, then just here's some good, you know, good, just to see how you guys are doing on your philosophical thinking. What happens if you have a society built on the pharaonic premise? When nature does not obey, how do you deal with that? How does that work in pharaonic societies when the tide comes in? In the England of Canute, you have this humility. You have this understanding of the power of nature and this unwillingness to adopt the pretense of a godlike power over it. Okay, but in a pharaonic society, you don't have that. So what do you tell the people? If Canute was a pharaoh, what would he say to his courtiers as the tide comes in? Right? How would this story have a different ending in a pharaonic society? Challenge question for everybody here. Because you got to understand this about pharaonic societies. We might have to, I don't know if I'm even going to tell you if you guys can't think of what the answer would be. I think I'm going to leave it hanging for a bit here. Keen?
I'm thinking maybe the other gods or the, you know, you think of gods like Horus, they are, the people have done something wrong, and that it's their punishment that you know, the higher gods above the pharaoh are punishing the people, and it's not really the pharaoh's fault.
All right, there's one offering. Well, I'm not going to comment on it quite yet. Abby, what do you think?
It could also possibly end in anger from the pharaoh.
Okay. Towards what?
Towards the Tai, towards the water, because it didn't heed his command.
That would not be very godlike, though, would it?
No.
Yeah, okay, so King's premise is an interesting one, right? If you are the Pharaoh, and you have this idea, this notion in your society of your godliness, and that the regulation of natural phenomenon is within your power, right? If it doesn't obey, what's the problem? Theo?
Well, I mean, another thing that could happen is that maybe the Pharaoh would get deposed as not being actually a god.
Okay. Well, now we are going towards this. That's where we're going to take things today here, is the whole issue of the liabilities of this kind of pretense, the liabilities of this type of, not a Canute-like, not an Anglo, we would call that Anglo-Saxon kind of tradition of humility, and that's the kind of thing that eventually kind of trickled down into American colonial society and into American society, this humility with regard to, even for those people who do believe in such a thing as a god, this kind of humility with regard to nature and with regard to any claims to supernatural powers or awareness. That's kind of a very European, especially English, type of perspective. And it's really, it's in the story of Canute. It's one of the reasons why the story of Canute is such a kind of a telling story, because you get that in this strain of Western civilization. And you get to the point where you get to people like the Founding Fathers, and what they say is religion has to be completely private. Because in any society in which you have this people like pharaohs who claim to know for sure, whatever, claim to have some kind of special conduit to the supernatural, then the Founding Fathers, having studied history, what they saw there was, and there was plenty of this, for instance, in the Dark Ages, was that those people then will use the apparatus of government to enforce a certain way of life on everybody else. And so the Founding Fathers took the view, all right, we are moving away from that whole model, that whole pharaonic type of society. We're going to have a society in which every human being has a right to pursue his own happiness. Every human being has a right to his own life. And we are not going to have any of this pretense of some people having some special conduit to the gods or some supernatural awareness and thus being able to force themselves on everybody else. Right? So we have this very different construct in our modern society. Very important contrast. In the pharaonic world, you would never get that kind of humility. You would never get that leads you to toleration and that leads you to religious freedom. Instead, you have the exact opposite. You have the premise, the pharaoh is a god king. Okay? And he's going to rule the people. He doesn't have to grow any crops. He doesn't have to deal with nature in any humble way. All right. So, but how does that really work? How can you have such a society at all? Here is our very practical problem. So Abby, put your hand down unless you have more to say on that there. This is what we're going to deal with here. It's a very practical problem of how to organize a pharaonic system. Because the premise is the pharaoh is this powerful godlike figure. How can you really do that? Now, let me lead you into this topic here so you can kind of get your head wrapped around this. The reality is, after Menes Narmer, let's go back to Menes Narmer, right? This powerful mythological almost king, right? And his great power and his conquest and so on. After him, how do you get the next pharaoh? And the pharaoh after that, and so on. How do you have an organized society that isn't constantly just war, right? Which, of course, would be chaos and be very destructive, and you'd never be able to really have any stability in a civilization like that. How do you get all the subsequent pharaohs, right? And have a real organized pharaonic society? Juliet?
Well, the next king would be Menes Narmer's son.
Okay.
Then his son.
Okay, so let's get right into, unflinchingly, into the mechanics of that whole system, right? In order to have a son, what does a pharaoh have to have? Worth putting in your notes. Abby?
A wife.
A wife, okay. And they are going to engage in perfectly human biological processes resulting in the birth of children, okay? And presumably they will have multiple children, especially in archaic times, in pre-industrial times. Having a child was absolutely not a typically successful activity. A large percentage of children died. And life was really, really hard. And so apart from this very, very dramatic outcome, now presumably if you're the pharaoh, you've got, you know, you have the most comforts, you have the best possible life in that sense. But regardless, right, what is the real human frailty and reality of your family life, of your human life? What are some of those features of that that are just not suitable to the pharaonic myth? There.
Well, people might die early.
Okay, so yeah, death of the pharaoh would be one. Death of the pharaoh's wife in childbirth, death of the infant or of a young child. All right, those are the extremes. Let's set those aside, even though we should make note of those because those are dangerous. But assuming we are having kind of just a dynastic flow, even there, what are some of the ungodly things that we see? Right? The human things. Abby?
I was thinking maybe one of the children could get lost, run away.
Okay, that's something. We can go much more kind of basic than that. Right, everybody here can imagine these things. What would be an example of something smelly that would be very unpharaonic, very ungodlike, but absolutely human? Jeez, nobody here's got a sense of humor. Timothy says B.O. Well, you've got lavender and other nice things that you can bathe in, you know, and olive oil and whatever else for the pharaohs. But there's something else. Nemo?
Poop.
Okay, poopy diapers, right? And all of that fun stuff of the reality of human life, right? That is very ungodlike. And what else? Babies cry, and babies spit up, and babies get sick, and people get sick, right? If you're living along the Nile, you probably got quite a few mosquitoes. What else is going to happen? Abby?
West Nile, malaria.
Yeah, we even have a disease named after the Nile, for crying out loud, right? Malaria, dengue fever, all of those other things that those mosquitoes will bring to us, and so on. All right, and so the reality of human life is messy. It is not godlike, right? So if you are the pharaoh, and you have this pharaonic family, right, this dynastic family, how do you maintain that image, that pharaonic image, given all of this real life? Because if the people, right, knew, if the people saw the reality of pharaonic life, it's no different than anybody else's, except that their beds are really comfortable because they're filled with feathers and it's all really nice, and people will wave fans and take care of them, and they have the nicest water from the best wells and so on. Okay, but the reality of the life is it's a human life. It's just a really elevated human life. How do you maintain that elevation? Is the real question. How do you keep up the image, right? Of your pharaonic greatness, of your godliness. Theo?
Well, so I can think of a couple things. You
okay.
could not really let anyone near you so that they can't see that you're just a natural human. You can also do fantastically resplendent things.
Okay.
Like just cover ridiculous amounts of things in gold.
All right. Very, very interesting. Okay, two really good offerings here. I want to talk about the first one because that is the most fundamental thing that has to happen. Right, so we already talked about the colossal monument tombs, right? So building pyramids is part of the pharaonic mythology, right? It's if you can command that, if you can make those pyramids, then it reinforces this myth of your godliness, right? It reinforces this culture of you as the central figure and of that godliness. So that's part of it. That was the second thing you said. But the first thing you said is important on the practical level, on a day-to-day practical level. You've got to achieve separation. You've got to achieve an aloofness, an elevation from the people. Because they can't see you as the same as them. You've got to maintain this image of yourself as the great godlike creature. So, yeah, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance when you do go out into regular society. You've got to have amazing robes. You've got to have an awesome crown. Like Rosie was chatting, you got to have a really big chair, a giant chariot. It's got to be drawn by elephants and processions of tigers on leashes and stuff like that. And there's got to be gold and there's got to be rupees and your crown's got to be really beautiful and all of that other stuff, right? And you're really high up. You got to have lots of guards and so on. Rosie, keep going.
What I was going to say was that I think I don't understand because it's like when they made pyramids, it said that they didn't have wheels, they hadn't invented wheels, so they couldn't use wheels to get them up. But then they had chariots.
Oh, so now that's actually a really interesting question. And I don't know. See, we don't know how they built the pyramids. And I honestly don't know at what point the Egyptians had the wheel for the purpose of chariots. We will see examples from about 1800 or so of murals that show wheeled vehicles. So that's an interesting question about when did the wheel penetrate into Egyptian society as a mechanical device, as a means of transportation. Quite frankly, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody really knows when it happened. But it was there in some ways, and we will see examples of it. So that's an interesting, you know, technicality of the issue. But let's assume that it is there in some means. Just because you have a chariot, for instance, doesn't necessarily mean that you know how to use a wheel to carry a 150-ton block, right? Because that's a whole different issue. And so what you would do with that is you would get some logs and you would pull the block over top of the rolling logs, which is kind of the principle of the wheel, but it's a different application of it. So you've got, you know, there are technical answers to those questions, Rosie. Again?
What I was going to say was I think it's funny because the pharaoh usually died before any of the other people, like the lower class people, because like I read a book and it said that he was like over pampered, so like he died younger than most other people.
Well, there you go. So now you're getting to this interesting challenge, right? Is again, that speaks to the issue of, you know, how to maintain the myth. Right? How to maintain the image of the society. And that's where I was going with it. Okay. And when it comes to the issue of the families of the pharaoh and the reality of family life, the realities of childhood, the realities of the frailty of human beings, especially, right, when we don't have medicine, modern scientific medicine to cure disease and so on, don't have a lot of the crucial things that we have today, the ability to produce and basically unlimited amount of food and so on, right? So your point about the pharaohs being pampered and in a sense being weak because of that was a part of this issue, okay? The pharaohs could not engage in normal life like everybody else. So they had to be elevated and separated from everybody else. Now, so here's where I wanted to go with that. And this will help you, I think, Rosie, a little bit. How do you achieve that? How do you get to be separate that way? What's it really going to look like? You got the Pharaoh at the top of this society. But there is some contact, right? Because we know taxes have to be collected. We know somebody's got to go read the Nile. And we know that there's priests that are handling all those various religious ceremonies and so on. So we can fill in this hierarchy. But how does the connection get made between the Pharaoh and the people is a really crucial fact that will help us to understand how this society would work. Beneath the Pharaoh, since I'm not seeing any hands shooting up here. Beneath the Pharaoh and the hierarchy, there was a direct relationship between the Pharaoh and a secondary figure. And I'm going to go ahead and chat this to you guys in the chat box. And so it's spelled and pronounced variously. Okay, you'll see it with different spellings and pronunciations. But the character's title was Vizier, is how I pronounce it. And so the vizier was the head of government. He was the head of the bureaucracy, which is to say, right? All of the officials, all of the people that do the work. Because the Pharaoh doesn't do it. Pharaoh is this pampered creature, as Rosie is saying, separate, elevated from the people, apart from them. And, you know, a very ceremonial character. And he can't get his hands dirty, literally or figuratively, right? In order to maintain this image. So there's got to be somebody that takes care of business. And that character is the vizier. Okay, so the vizier was the head of government. He interacted with the Pharaoh's household. He interacted with all the other officials, and transmitted, the commands. He transmitted the information back to the Pharaoh. He was the conduit between the God King and the real world. So, the benefits of that, in light of, you know, what we've said, in light of the necessity of the Pharaoh staying separate, we can see what the benefits are. But what are the pitfalls? What are the liabilities of a system in which you have to use an intermediary like this? And, you know, this is the person that's actually in charge. Juliet?
It goes corrupt very quickly.
Why?
Because there's that second person, once they have power, it just corrupts them.
Okay, so they're the ones that have the real power. Because the Pharaoh is always removed from the day-to-day functioning of the government. He's not supposed to have to do it. So the vizier is the one who's actually got the power. This is the problem of the system here, right? And so this is a really really crucial mechanical feature of a pharaonic society. For those of you who have studied other bits of history, let me give you an interesting example. Does anybody remember that Japanese society had a very pharaonic structure to it as well? Does anybody remember what was the name of the official that actually took care of business? And as a result of, again, this system did not function well and ultimately collapsed as well. But the Japanese emperor, who's, you know, nobody would allow him to get his hands dirty. So who ended up being really in charge of Japan? This is me extending the theme here to the universal. Theo?
Well, they were called the Shoguns.
The Shoguns, right, very good. So there's an interesting review item for those of you who are interested in extending the theme here, right? The Shoguns in Japan are the viziers of pharaonic Egypt. The challenge is always the same. The challenge of delegating power. Because you believe in power, and you want to have a monarch, but the monarch needs to have a certain kind of mythical distance and image quality to his rule that you want to maintain. That's a part of his aura, right? But you've got to have the practical day-to-day business of government taken care of. So here we have two societies, thousands of miles apart, based on the same premise, and stagnating in exactly the same way. Pharaonic Egypt, and thousands of years later, Imperial Japan. If you study the history of Japan, it's really, really fascinating, because the Japanese eventually ran into modernity. I mean, Egypt didn't have to do that, but the Japanese system was still in existence when a certain Commodore Perry of the United States Navy showed up, and pretty soon the Japanese imperial system unraveled. We go all the way through to the world wars, but now we have this Japanese society that is among the most advanced in the world. Fascinating kind of parallelism there. But Egyptian society didn't have that issue for thousands of years. It didn't run into a United States. It didn't exist. But as we're going to see, it is going to run into its neighbors eventually. And that's going to be a serious problem, because the pharaonic system is designed for Egypt. It's designed for a Nilocentric society that is separate. And so hopefully you can still hear me, Rosie. So we'll see that it's not easy to maintain, because the pharaohs are human and they need other people to take care of the business of government. They need the vizier in particular. And if the vizier has the power, then he's going to be corrupted by that power. And that's going to lead to, in the worst cases, a struggle for power between the viziers and the pharaohs. Who wins that struggle if it ever happens? No way to know. That's really a rhetorical question, because you can't really know. I mean, if the, you know, depends on how well the viziers have organized themselves, right? There's no way to answer that question, but you can imagine. So we'll get to this first juncture in Egyptian history on Monday, where this whole pharaonic system that leads to the construction of the colossal pyramid tombs, and that works dynasty after dynasty, hundreds of years, it falls apart. It falls apart. And the crisis arises because of the very real humanity, frailty, weakness of the pharaohs, and their inability to maintain that mystique, the inability to maintain the system, and the corruptible viziers and other officials feeling themselves to be in a position that they would have a greater advantage rather than maintaining the system, overturning it. Theo, go ahead.
So there was something I thought was interesting about the pharaohs, is that in order to preserve their bloodline, they would marry one of their siblings. So that could potentially, like, make their descendants' genes really terrible, which could make them live of even less long.
Absolutely. So there's another really interesting problem that most dynasties in history encounter. We see that in European societies with the so-called Holy Roman Emperors. Right? So they want to maintain their dynastic bloodline, so they all intermarry, and they end up being mentally handicapped, because we know from modern genetics that's not healthy. And ultimately, that leads to all kinds of infirmities. And so you see that in Egyptian society, you see it in European society, you see it again. So there's another interesting problem of the pharaonic construct. So that's another good one. But right now we're going to focus on this technicality of having a ruler who's, you know, supposed to maintain this godlike quality, but as a result, he's separate from the people, and there's this layer underneath him, this hierarchy of power, that if it doesn't cooperate, results in the overturning of the system. All right. I'm sure that's a lot to chew on, so hopefully that will lead to some interesting thoughts and questions and so on. So anyway, you've got a while to let that sit and see how you like it and what you want to, if you want to talk about it further. Fantastic. We'll bring it up again on Monday and go from there. We should be able to get a good rhythm next week. Of course, tomorrow is History Through Art because we have a short week. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.